Okay, Shabbat Shalom, and welcome to our Sabbath morning study. It's great to be back. I am still slightly jet-lagged, I think, but I'm on a road to recovery. I slept really well last night. From the looks of my friend's post on Facebook, it looks like most of the tour group has made it home. For those of you who have been living under a rock and don't know, I've been in Israel for 2 weeks, 15 days counting travel, and so it's been really nice. And as you can imagine, I am extremely excited and energized coming back from that long in the land of Israel. We toured from Jerusalem. We started our tour in Jerusalem with 3 nights and visited all sorts of biblically related sites in and around Jerusalem. We then went to the Galilee, where we spent 3 nights there and surveyed the land all around the Galilee, including a couple of surprise things that we discovered. One was a hike down the Arbel Cliffs. Arbel Cliffs are mentioned in Josephus, and I've always wanted to go there. In fact, Tabor has been there for many, many times, more than 64 times, I think, and he's never actually visited this particular site. But we walked down, some of us walked down the Arbel Cliffs and saw some breathtaking views of the Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee. So that was one beautiful surprise that we had, many, many others. And then after that, after our 3 nights in the Galilee, we went to the desert, where we spent time at Biblical Tamar Park and visited sites around the wilderness region. Some of the group, half exactly, spent 3 more nights in Jerusalem in the Old City. So I have many stories to tell, and I want to tell those, but I don't want to do it this morning. So I hope to write up sort of a summary of our tour. And some of the people who went on the tour plan to bring some of this to you in the form of a map, sort of show you all the places that we went, write a brief description. And some of you followed me on Facebook and saw the beautiful pictures. But this will provide a context. So hopefully Ed Casey is listening. I think he's going to help me put this together after we get back in the system of things. So, but stay tuned for that. I did bring with me many prayers from many of you who sent requests in asking me while I'm in Jerusalem if I would pray. There were others also who prayed for many of the needs. And one of the things that I wanted to say is that I was greatly moved, as I always am, and honored to be able to do that for people. But the other thing is that I realize that many people are dealing with many, many things. We just don't know. Consider that in your daily walk. Think about that. So just a couple of prayer requests that I pulled from my time there. One is a young man by the name of Patrick. I want you to pray for Patrick. He's undergoing some serious health issues right now. It's improving, but please keep him in your prayers. And then a young lady by the name of Casey. I'd ask you to pray for Casey as well. I want to say thank you to our local group for holding things together while I was gone. Thank you very much, Jodell, for teaching for me for a couple of weeks. And as always, the amazing Dave Cole for bringing the teaching to the people. So thank you very much. I want to begin with a phrase that many of you are familiar with. It comes from the 119th Psalm, verse 18. It says, Gal einai v'avita niflaot mitorateka. Open my eyes, and I will look for wonderful things from your Torah. You know, when I was on the plane and I was traveling back, I knew that this particular week I would be teaching from the 16th chapter of Genesis. And I had to think, what is it in the 16th chapter of Genesis that I can use to teach people a valuable and meaningful lesson from the Torah? So I began to think about this passage in Psalm 119. And I began to pray that God would begin to open my eyes so that I might see some wonderful things in the Torah. You know, quite often, especially when I would teach from the annual cycle of readings, because the material gives you more to work with in an annual cycle than it does in the triennial cycle, it allows you some flexibility. And so normally, I would not be teaching from this portion, because I would probably lean more heavily towards the 17th chapter of Genesis, which, according to this cycle of readings, will be next week's class. But I would have focused more on something that I would have found to be more substantive when I'm thinking about teaching valuable lessons from the Torah. But as it is, I had to look closely at Genesis 16, which is the story of a woman named Hagar. And I want to talk to you today about an Egyptian slave girl. We are following the ancient triennial cycle of Torah readings, which means that it's going to take approximately 3 to 3.5 years to work through the 5 books of Moses, as they're called, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And so this, today's class, is the 11th class in my series from the Bible's first book, from the book known in Hebrew as Bereshit, means beginnings. It's also known as the book of Genesis. We're presently in what could accurately be defined as the patriarchal narratives. That is, we're working through material that deals with the lives of the fathers and the mothers, the patriarchs and the matriarchs of the people of Israel. We're studying the life of a man named Avram, later known as Abraham, who becomes known by the designation the father of all the faithful. It behooves us then to study the life of Abraham and study it closely. I want to begin today in the prophet Isaiah, because I want to do a slight bit of recap in order to lead us into today's study. If you go with me to Isaiah, to the 51st chapter, in verse 1. You should be familiar with this, but it stands as a single text that draws us, literally draws us, and pushes us into studying the life of Avram. It says in Isaiah 51:1, "Hearken to me, you that," literally in the Hebrew, "chase after righteousness. You," plural, "that seek Yehovah. Look unto the rock whence you were hewn, and to the quarry of the pit from which you were dug. Look unto Abraham, your father, and unto Sarah that bare you. For when he was called, he was but one, and I blessed him and made him many." Isaiah's telling us, if we belong to this group, and I believe and hope that you all do, who literally chase after, pursue after righteousness, you who seek Yehovah, we're told to look to Abraham and to Sarai, adding very clearly that he was only one when he was called, but because of God's blessing, he became many. I want to highlight a point that's going to lead into the class today, that one of the single carrying points in the narrative of the story of Avram is that he had a promise of progeny. The blessing that he would receive, one of the key points in that blessing, is that he would have many descendants. And I want to especially note that in context, this story of the blessing of many seed, it's a message of hope when everything seems hopeless. I want you to consider that this deals with the miraculous workings of God on behalf of His chosen. You see, the Hebrew Bible is essentially, as my teacher often puts it, the story of one man's family. I mean, up until we get to Genesis chapter 12, the Bible presents the story as a very universal book. We begin with Adam, the father literally of humanity. We worked our way through his descendants, the good and the bad. And we began to focus on the line of Shem from Noah's line. And with Shem, we began to follow that through. And we come to Terah. We come to Avram. But this particular family of which we are now focused, beginning in chapter 12 of Genesis, the family of a man named Avram, is a family that has both a unique blessing as well as a unique calling. They are indeed promised blessing, but it's with a price. It's with the idea that they would not hold that blessing to themselves, but that they would in turn pass that blessing on, because as the Torah states in three separate and distinct places, that your seed, all nations of the earth, will be blessed because of you. The prophet Amos puts it this way in chapter 3, verse 2, the first part of this passage in Amos 3, 2. God tells through the prophet Amos, the children of Israel, you only have I known of all the families of the earth. It's with the descendants of this one man, but one when he's called, who became many. It's through the descendants of this one man that God develops a very special relationship and assigns them with a very, very important task. I want to highlight today in the class that the miraculous cannot, nor should it ever be ignored. We're talking today, and we will for the next few weeks, about a birth that is promised that's nothing short of miraculous. It's miraculous on many counts, not the least of which is that the man to whom the seed is promised is very old. Now, the older I get, the less old it sounds, but he is 75 when he leaves Haran. And he doesn't have children. And yet the promise is that he will be a father of multitudes. And not just that he'll be a father of multitudes, but that his seed will in many ways bring blessing to the entire world. According to Genesis 12:4, if you want this in your notes, he's 75 when he receives the call. The patriarch Avram at the time of his call was married to a woman named Sarai. And to further complicate the matter of the promise, she too is old. It's not like he's old and she's young. She's also aged. And then there is another factor. To make this miracle seem even more difficult, she's barren. If you look with me to our first introduction to this woman, to Sarai, go with me to Genesis chapter 11. And beginning in verse 29, we're going back a little ways to set the stage. It says, and Avram and Nahor took them wives. The name of Avram's wife was Sarai. The name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. And Sarai was barren. She had no child. It's to this most unlikely couple that we, the followers of the faith, that we, the readers of the narrative, are caused to look in order to understand just how miraculous the promise is going to have to be. I want you to look with me through several places in the text in the earlier chapters that we've covered in previous teachings. And I just want to highlight a couple of things. If you begin with me in Genesis chapter 12, I'm just going to read a few points. In Genesis chapter 12, beginning in verse 1, "Now Jehovah said unto Avram, get thee out of thy country." In Hebrew, it's lech lecha, walk for yourself. "From your kindred, from your father's house, unto a land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and you be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless you, and him that esteems you lightly I will curse. And in you shall all the families of the earth be blessed." This single man, this single aged man, is told that he is going to be made into a goy gadol, a great nation, a big nation. But he has no seed. In chapter 12, verse 7, if you follow along in the narrative, it says, "And Jehovah appeared unto Avram and said, unto your seed I will give this land." But I want you to think today as I work through these that Avram has no seed. At this point, he's old, he's left everything with which he's familiar, and he keeps getting a promise about a great multitude that will descend from him. If you go to chapter 13, in verse 15, it says, "For all the land which you see, to you will I give it, and to your seed forever." You see, Avram has to imagine in order to think about what is to come. It's one thing if the promise was, "Avram, look all around you, because to you I will give this seed." Now that requires faith. It requires faith to believe that in the midst of people who've lived there longer, that he would somehow inherit that personally. But the promise goes beyond what Avram sees with his eyes. He must see with a deeper sight. He must have insight, and he must have what we will notice in a little while in the text. He must have faith, confidence, and trust in what he's being told. But it's not just that he's told that he'll be given this land and that his seed will be given this land, but he's further told before he has any children, verse 16 of chapter 13 in Genesis, "And I will make your seed as the dust of the earth, so that if a man can number the dust of the earth, then may your seed also be numbered." But Avram doesn't have any seed. In chapter 15, which we covered in the last time that I taught, Avram has a vision. Much of the vision is dark in many ways. But he's told by God that Avram has a shield and that his reward is great. Jehovah says, "I am thy shield. Your reward is very great." And Avram responds in the vision, and he questions that promise. Now, one of the things that stood out to me in the class preparation phase this last night is that there's no sin in questioning. You know, I think a lot of times people would consider that a lack of faith. It says this, you just have to believe it, you can't question it. But I want you to think about this. Avram is told over and over and over, "To you and to your seed, I'll give this place." And he doesn't have seed yet. There's no sin in reminding God. In Isaiah chapter 43, verse 26, Jehovah himself says, "Put me in remembrance of my word." He actually encourages believers to question. I would encourage you to do it respectfully, but nonetheless, when we see something in Scripture, we have to take note that these people of faith
would often question. What Avram does is he reminds Jehovah in this vision that up to this point, despite the repeated promises of progeny, that he remains childless. In fact, in chapter 15 of Genesis, verse 2, the translation that Dr. Tabor uses is, he goes forth stripped. He has nothing. In fact, he calls to mind as he looks about him that the best he can do to work this out on his own is to have Damasek Eliezer of Damascus, his servant, who's a foreigner, to inherit all that God's promised. So he's saying, As I look about and I hear about this promise and the many blessings, so far, Jehovah, all that is before me is a servant. There is no seed. In fact, he even states this plainly, I have no seed. Once again, Avram is told that the promised seed will surely come. He's specifically told that this Damasek Eliezer of Damascus, will not be the one that will inherit Avram. He will not be the one to whom the promises pass, but that through Avram, through his own issue, his own seed, literal, physical, the blessing and the promise will pass. Against all odds. You see, I think a lot of times when we read these stories, we miss the miraculous. We miss the full impact of what the story is really about. Jehovah will take Avram outside of his tent in this vision and cause him to look into the night sky. And in verse 5, he shows him a star-filled sky, as you can only imagine in our modern day, in many of our filled cities, with all the lights, it's very difficult to imagine just what Avram saw. But if you've ever been in a remote place, away from the streetlights, in a desert or out at sea, where there's no distraction for your eyes, and you can see the beauty of a star-filled sky, this is what Jehovah shows Avram. And he says, if you can count the stars, then you'll be able to number your descendants. If you'll go with me to Genesis chapter 15, I want to read verse 5 and 6 because it sets the stage. In verse 5, he brought him forth abroad and said, look now toward heaven and number the stars. If you're able to number them, and he said unto him, so shall your seed be. I taught previously that many people will say that the promises to Abraham belong to a single coming eschatological redemptive figure and not to the people of Israel. This is probably one of the biggest oversights, one of the biggest mistakes, because it takes and it forms what is known as replacement theology, where the intended recipient is stripped of that which God promises. The descendant that's being spoken of here, the seed that is being spoken of, is not a singular figure, but a group of people. And that's why the image is so powerful. Look at the stars. This is what your seed. I'm talking about this huge, vast number. Look at the dust of the earth, Avram. If you can count the dust particles, so shall your seed be. Very clear. Verse 6. And he, Avram, believed, he trusted, he had confidence in Jehovah, and it was reckoned to him for righteousness. And this particular passage is used by many to talk about the faith of Avram. Avram does indeed believe what he's told. He trusts it. He has confidence. But remember, he can still question. Questioning one's promise does not take away your faith. I think a lot of times people think that it does, but it doesn't. My question for you today is very simple. Do we trust in the biblical promises even when their fulfillment is seemingly delayed? Do we trust in the promises even when it seems to be delayed? Because I think a lot of times we go through periods in our life, in our spiritual journey, where we feel like it's just been so long, that the journey has brought us a long way, and sometimes we feel we haven't arrived. But I want to highlight some things from today's story, which hopefully will give you confidence restored in the promises that were made not only to the patriarchs, but have a relevance for us today. We tend to read the stories of the biblical text. We tend to read these narratives, and I think quite often we missed details that are provided in the text. We read these stories, and they're listed in order, so to speak, but as you read through them, it seems as if it's happening day by day by day. As if Avram woke up every morning to hear the lovely voice of his Creator. But that's not the case. In fact, some of you might not notice this, but today's narrative in Genesis chapter 16, the events that I will cover in today's class happen a decade after he leaves Haran, moving towards 11 years. So he's given this beautiful promise. And I will bless you and make your name great. You be a blessing. I will multiply you and so forth. He's told this, but it's been 10 years. It's not been one chapter. It's not been two chapters or three or four chapters. It's been a decade. And he still goes about stripped. I want you to think about that. And now, not only is it a decade into the story, he's in a new place. He and Sarah aren't getting any younger. It's building goes. It's setting the stage for even more of a miracle. You know, one of the things that I think about as I study the Tanakh, as I study the Hebrew Bible, is that God is a God of miracles. He doesn't need things to go as we would think it needs to go in order to fulfill His word. You'll recall many stories where when the prophet goes to the woman who has no food and she's told to go get a jar, and the provision is provided as she pours, and she begins to fill from that which she doesn't have, and she must have more. She continues to use it, multiplies until she has no more room to put what God provides. Quite often we read stories where the battles, for instance, of Gideon, where he begins with a large number of troops, but he's thinking he needs vast numbers when God doesn't require that. And you'll recall that the story continues until he gets a select group of people through which God can work. I think that often we become so enlightened in our intellect that we begin to lose sight of the fact that we serve a God who can perform the miraculous. I want to read today from the Transparent English Version, the 16th chapter, and then provide some commentary to what we are discussing. So if you'll go there, hopefully you have this particular translation. The Transparent English Bible is a work of Dr. James Tabor, as most of you know. If we have new people, you can find this on the web. We're posting not only on our Facebook group, the United Israel Facebook group, we're also posting these translation portions on the United Israel website, unitedisrael.org, so you can get these as we post them. Genesis chapter 16, beginning in verse 1, and Sarai, the woman of Avram, did not bring forth to him. And there was to her a house servant, an Egyptian, and her name was Hagar. And Sarai said toward Avram, "Look, please, Jehovah has held back from bringing forth. Come, please, toward my house servant. Perhaps I will be built from her." And Avram hearkened to the voice of Sarai. And Sarai, the woman of Avram, took Hagar the Egyptian, her house servant, from the end of 10 years of the sitting of Avram in the land of Canaan, and gave her to Avram, her man, to him for a woman. And he came toward Hagar, and she became pregnant. And she saw that she became pregnant. She made light of her strong one in her eyes. And Sarai said toward Avram, "My violence be upon you. I gave my house servant into your bosom, and she saw that she had become pregnant, and I am made light in her eyes. Jehovah will judge between me and between you." And Avram said toward Sarai, "Look, your servant is in your hand. Do to her the good in your eyes." And Sarai brought her low, and she fled from her face. The messenger of Jehovah found her by the spring of water in the desert, by the spring on the way of Shur. And he said, "Hagar, house servant of Sarai, where from this have you come, and toward where are you walking?" And she said, "From the face of Sarai, my strong one, I'm fleeing." And the messenger of Jehovah said to her, "Return to your strong one and make yourself low under her hands." And the messenger of Jehovah said to her, "Making abundant, I will surely made abundant your seed, and it will not be counted from abundance." The messenger of Jehovah said toward her, "Look, you're pregnant and bringing forth a son, and you will call his name Ishmael, because Jehovah has hearkened toward your lowness. And he will be a wild ass soil creature, his hand against all, and the hand of all against him, and against the face of all his brothers he will dwell." She called the name of Jehovah, the one speaking toward her, "You are El Roi," for she said, "Have I also here looked after the one who sees me?" And therefore he called the well Be'er Lachai Roi, "Look, between Kadesh and between Beret." And Hagar brought forth a son for Avram, and Avram called the name of his son that Hagar brought forth Ishmael. And Avram was a son of 86 years at the bringing forth of Hagar of Ishmael to Avram. Now, first reading, one might say, what could we learn, spiritually edifying as it were, from that particular story? There's a Jewish dictum, a Jewish saying that suggests that the events in the lives of the fathers is often repeated or played out in some form or fashion in the lives of the sons. In other words, things that happen in events described as historical fact often hint or allude to something which will take place later in history. Perhaps it goes to the passage in Ecclesiastes where it says, "There's nothing new under the sun. That which has been is that which shall be." You'll recall that often these stories play out, and this is why it became such a popular dictum in Jewish literature. In our last class on Avram's vision, Avram is shown a very dark vision involving his seed, which he does not have at this point. Even before he has children, he's told this. If you go with me to Genesis 15, Genesis chapter 15, beginning in verse 12, says, and this is a vision, by the way, "And when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Avram, and lo, a horror of great darkness fell upon him. And he said unto Avram, Know of a surety that your seed shall be sojourners in a land that's not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. And also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterwards shall they come out with great substance. But you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age, and in the fourth generation they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet full. In this dark vision, we're not told, and nor was Abraham, who it is that will enslave the seed of Avram. Only that that the seed of Avram will be aliens in a land not theirs, that their seed, that his seed will be enslaved, oppressed for 400 years, that God will judge the one enslaving the promised seed, and that finally the promised seed will leave slavery with great possessions, coming back in the fourth generation. Today's reading, following immediately after this dark vision, introduces us to an Egyptian slave girl, one named Hagar. Now, Rashi says that Hagar happens to be the daughter of Pharaoh. Now, this goes beyond what we find in the text. We're not indicated, there's no indication in the text that this Hagar is of any importance. She's simply described as an Egyptian slave girl, and I tend to like to go with what the Scripture says. So let's assume that when the Scripture says that she's an Egyptian slave girl that belongs to Sarai, that that's exactly what she is. We don't know anything else, so let's go with what we know. Remember now, it's been 10 years since the promise was made to Avram. It's been a decade. Sarai is still barren. And she offers to Avram her slave girl because in her mind, she's aware of this promise most definitely, or I would think that she is. That's not stated either at this point. But Avram certainly knows. But because she has not yet brought forth, in fact, she even says that she's been withheld from bringing forth, so she offers up a solution of her own. Now, this is one of the first things that I want us to think about. In the promise, when the promise is given, they're not given the method by which it will come to pass, but this certainly isn't it. So she provides Avram with her slave girl, Hagar. And as she puts it, that through this giving of Hagar, she might be built up. And one of the things that I noticed as I worked through, often the writer, the biblical writer, will provide an echo of an earlier account. So I would call this an echo from Eden. As I read the text, and as any careful reader will take notice, that there is an echo of an earlier account in the book of Genesis in what follows. It says that the man listens to his woman, and then the woman took and gave. Where does that connect with an earlier account? We read in chapter 3 of Genesis that Adam listened to Eve, and then it says she took and gave. It's the same verbs, listened, took, and gave. These three verbs occur again in this story today, where Avram listened to Sarai, and she took and gave to him, Hagar. Now, as you will probably know from reading both of these accounts, the outcome of each is similar. In fact, I think it's no accident. I think the writer is quite aware of what the way he is recording this and wants us to notice this connection and the subsequent happenings and how the stories do relate in a way. And what I get from this is that by passing over the command or the promise, trouble comes. When we begin to seek out ways to fulfill on our own what it is that God has promised, quite often we overstep our bounds, and I think quite often we make missteps. So Avram, we're told in the story, went into Hagar and she conceived. But rather than the expected building up, what Sarai believed might build her up, it actually brings about the total opposite. We're told that the slave girl begins to look lightly upon the way the translation that we read today reads, her strong one, her mistress. So I want you to think about this. The roles become reversed. This slave girl begins to look down upon Sarai because she has conceived and Sarai can't. The writer of Proverbs would later include behavior such as Haggai's towards Sarai as one of three things under which the earth trembles. Let me show you. Go with me to the book of Proverbs, just so that you get the impact of what's going on here. In Proverbs chapter 30, beginning in verse 21, for three things the earth doth tremble, and for four it cannot bear. For a servant when he's king, and a fool when he's filled with food. For an odious woman when she is married, and a handmaid that is heir to her mistress. These are four things which are little upon the earth, but they exceedingly wise. Whenever a handmaid begins to look down upon her mistress, if you will, it causes the earth to tremble. It's an upset in the normal order of things, and that's the way this is presented. You'll recall also in 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 6, this the way that, in fact, let's go there. Let's go to 1 Samuel, 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 6. And her rival provoked her sore to make her fret because Jehovah had shut up her womb. This is a story, as you know, of Hannah who wants badly to have children, but her womb is closed. And this other woman makes light of her condition and causes her great trouble. So this is a very tense time in the home of Avram, as you can imagine. The women aren't getting along whatsoever. Sarai is enraged, and we read about it in Genesis chapter 16, verse 5. So I'm going to read that once again from our translation. Genesis chapter 16, verse 5 says the following. Sarai said toward Avram, my violence be upon you. I gave my house servant into your bosom, and she saw that she had become pregnant, and I made light in her eyes. Jehovah will judge between me and between you. Now, careful reading of this isn't required. One can very easily see that she puts a lot of pressure on Avram to take action to resolve this problem. Avram, very quick, as many men are, to resolve the issue, says, you do whatever you want, baby. It's up to you. Whatever makes you happy. Because she's very, very mad. So Avram gives Hagar into his woman Sarai's hands. And it says that Sarai brought her low and Hagar fled into the wilderness. And the idea that we get is oppression. That she oppresses Hagar. Now, some might read the story and say, well, Hagar deserved it because she looked on Sarai with this contempt. Now, a lot of people from this point are focused only on the promise and resolving this issue for God. So they will champion Sarai's cause and side against Hagar. Cast the woman out. We'll read this later in Genesis 21. We're not going there at this point. But the idea is that most of us, because of our biblical understanding and we know how the story plays out, we don't feel for Hagar at this point because we side with Sarai. But I want to bring up a couple of things that might make us think differently about this particular story. One of the things that benefits us in going through slowly and carefully, chapter by chapter, is that we're forced to look deeply into the story. So at this point, I want you to think, and you don't have to answer this now, but just whose side are you on at this point? Sarai, the one who will ultimately bring forth the promised child, or Hagar? Now, in this particular story, what I want to point out is that this story confirms what I said earlier about hints and allusions of the lives of the descendants when we look at the lives of the forebears. Now, what do I mean by that? Sarah will bring low. She will oppress an Egyptian. Have you ever heard, you reap what you sow? Now, have you ever thought that sometimes when you plant something, your children might reap it? See, a lot of times we don't think that far in advance when we make a mistake or when we treat someone with contempt or when we oppress a certain person. You know, I think sometimes we would be willing to accept the consequences for our actions with no problem. But when we begin to think that what we do now might have repercussions on our descendants, would it cause you to act differently? Sarai oppresses, brings low an Egyptian, and then it says, the writer wants us to know in chapter 16, verse 7, that the Egyptian flees into the wilderness. Now, in a strange reversal of roles later in biblical history, we see something come about. We see something grow. And we see something manifested that we probably couldn't have seen before. Egypt will later bring low Israel. Egypt will later oppress Israel. Exodus chapter 1, verse 12, for instance. And then Israel will flee into the wilderness in Exodus chapter 14, verse 5. Now, sure, we could say, well, look, don't connect the two. It's not in any way because of what Sarai did. It's simply because God wanted to save his people. But I want us to think about the repercussions of our present behavior in light of what is to come. One will also note, by the way, that it just so happens that it's an Ishmaelite group who carried Joseph into Egypt. Now, if you know your biblical stories, when you get into Genesis chapter 37, in fact, let's look at that. Go with me to Genesis chapter 37, because remember, who is Hagar's son? Ishmael. Go to Genesis 37 and verse 28, I believe. And there passed by Midianites, merchantmen, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they brought Joseph into Egypt, where Israel ultimately would go through an oppression by the people of Egypt. Are they connected at all? Some might say no. But the connection is there for some reason, and I think it's worth noting. There's a lesson in this Torah portion, I think, that stands out for me. And that is, the Torah stresses over and over how important it is for one to treat a servant right. Is it ever justified to treat a servant harshly? In the Torah, we're told over and over, the children of Israel, after they come out of the land of Egypt, they're told to love even the stranger and to treat the servants right, because you ought to know, he says. You ought to know the heart of a servant. Could it be that Israel, in its exalted role, must learn a valuable lesson along the way? If they are going to be a people to whom the nations come and bow, how then should they behave towards those people? Should they lord over them? Or should they be good in their behavior towards those to whom they have a responsibility? Israel was enslaved. Avram is shown this in a dark vision. He says, ultimately, the ones who treat them harshly will be judged by God, and they'll come out and they will indeed inherit their freedom. Ultimately, throughout the prophets, we read of this great exaltation, but I want you to notice something that the prophet Isaiah makes extremely clear, is that no matter how exalted this promised seed becomes, their greatest title is servant. If you want to be great in God's kingdom, you have to learn to be a servant. And when you're in a position of authority, you must always remember how to treat a servant. So that's one lesson. Perhaps another lesson that we learned from this particular Torah reading is that one must be patient when it comes to the promises contained in God's Word. There's no need in rushing things or setting forth to accomplish that which has been promised. Doesn't mean that you wait while sitting on your hands. There's work to be done, that's clear. But should we look for ways to jump in and help God bring about what He's promised? I think there's a caution in this particular story. I once read an ancient parable by a rabbi by the name of Jesus or Yeshua, who talked about a master who grew impatient and began to oppress his servants. That behavior doesn't bode well. I think that it's important. One must have trust in the promises of God, and that trust, I believe, does indeed yield righteousness, but often we must exercise great patience. We tend to look at these stories, as I've said, almost as if they're happening on the fly, that Abram gets up in the morning and God says, go here, go there, do this, do that. But there are years and decades between hearing the voice. We can never grow impatient. In fact, I want to read a few passages that the word that I feel is very much a key component of this week's lesson is a word in Hebrew, chacha, and it means to wait. It means to wait. I want to begin in the book of Habakkuk. If you'll go with me to Habakkuk chapter 2. Beginning in verse 1, says the following. I will stand upon my watch and set me upon the tower and will look forth to see what He will speak with me and what I shall answer concerning my complaint. Jehovah answered me and said, write the vision, make it plain upon tablets, that he may run that reads it. For the vision is yet for the appointed time. Here's a key. these things that are promised take place at the appointed time. We'll see when the seed is born. God's very clear to tell Avram and Sarai, at this time you'll bring forth. It's appointed. You can't jump ahead. I continue in verse 3, for the vision is yet for the appointed time, and it hastens toward the end, and shall not lie. Though it tarry, wait for it, because it will surely come, it will not delay. You know, one of the passages that's been on my heart since July of last year, when my world began to change quickly before me, for me personally, I'm reminded of this passage that in its time, I will hasten it. It will feel as though things are moving quickly. But it's not too early. It's not too late. It's at the appointed time. If it tarries, wait for it, because the word of promise will surely come. It doesn't lie. But see, we like to hurry. You know, a lot of times we read in Scripture, people long for the day of Jehovah. But if you read carefully, it says this is not a day you should be rushing along. A lot of times people tend to want to rush things. What we should be praying for is that the appointed time will come and that we will be blessed. You know, like the prophet, like Daniel says, blessed is he who achieves this particular day. But don't rush it. Look with me to Isaiah chapter 8, please. Isaiah chapter 8. And I just want to read. I'm not necessarily going to read everything, but I want to hit the high points. If you look at verse 16 of Isaiah chapter 8. Bind up the testimony. Seal the instruction among my disciples. And I will wait for Jehovah that hides his face from the house of Jacob. And I will look for him. You see, there are times in the spiritual lives, even of Isaiah, Jeremiah felt it, all the prophets, and even today in our own spiritual lives, we sometimes feel that we are in the hiding of the face, the Hester Panim, a time when, as it says in 1 Samuel chapter 3, that the word of Jehovah was rare in those days. Yakar. It's translated precious sometimes, but the idea is that people aren't hearing directly from God. What Isaiah gives is practical advice. Bind up the testimony, seal the instructions among the disciples, and then wait. Again, it doesn't mean wait and do nothing. Because what did I just say? You have to bind up the testimony and seal the Torah. There are things to be done, but ultimately there is a wait that's required. Go with me to Isaiah chapter 30, please. Isaiah chapter 30, beginning in verse 18. Let's just read verse 18. And therefore will Jehovah wait. Notice it's not just us, but it's Jehovah. He will wait that he may be gracious unto you, and therefore will he be exalted, that he may have mercy upon you, for Jehovah is a God of justice. Now get this, blessed are all they that wait for him. Jehovah, it says, is waiting that he might be gracious unto you and extend mercy unto you. In the meantime, blessed are those who wait for Jehovah. This idea of waiting is very important. Look at Isaiah chapter 64. By the way, Isaiah is key on this. It's not used that often in Scripture. Isaiah 64, verse 4. In Hebrew, it's verse 3. So let me make sure I'm at the right. Isaiah 64. I don't know. I must have wrote it down wrong. Okay, skip that. I'll come back and find it. In Zephaniah 3, verse 8, we're told, therefore, wait for me.
if you're looking, if I confused you, look in Isaiah 64. I'm pretty sure I'm right, but Isaiah 64 has a reference to this waiting. If you go with me to Psalm 33, verse 20, Psalm 33, verse 20, I've got a couple more. It says the following. Our soul waited for Jehovah. He is our help and our shield. Recall the promise to Avram in Genesis 15. I am your shield and your reward is great. But notice, Avram must wait. Just as David tells us here that we too must wait. Indeed, he's our shield. Indeed, he's our help. And the last verse that I have in my notes on this idea is Psalm 106. Psalm 106, verse 13. I'll chalk up my miss there to jet lag, so forgive me. Psalm 106, 13. They soon forgot his works. They waited not for his counsel. See, it's easy to forget God's work, his miraculous workings, when we don't wait on his counsel. Hagar, the slave girl of Sarai, the Egyptian, is mentioned in two separate stories, two narratives. One here in Genesis 16, the subject of today's teaching, and later in Genesis chapter 21. Now, in both of these accounts, she encounters this mysterious figure known to us as the Malak Yehovah, the Messenger Yehovah, this one who comes in various mysterious form and meets face to face with humans. In the case of Hagar, the Malak comes twice, once in this chapter, once in chapter 21, offering advice as well as providing blessing to Hagar. I guess one of the things that strikes me is that we're soon to compartmentalize the characters in the Bible as good and bad. Hagar's bad, she's the Egyptian, she's the slave. Sarai is the princess, she's the Israelite. But we have to be careful when we do that. Because I think often we overlook some things in the story that we shouldn't overlook. We don't have to excuse Hagar's behavior towards Sarah. But I expect more of Sarai. I should, just as more is expected from us. There's a rabbinic saying that's with the people of God, I'm paraphrasing, God exacts from them to even to a hair's breadth. One is not excused based on being a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob from any bad behavior. The high priest of Israel, Aaron, is not excused for his sins. Nor is Moses excused for his sin. Nor is David excused for his sin. The beautiful thing about the Hebrew Bible is it presents its heroes, its men and women, these great ones of faith, as not being flawless. But we're given these lives as examples to look at and see. We notice when they do right. We notice when they do wrong. And we follow the consequence of their actions. And hopefully these things begin to seek in, inside, cause us to seek, how then should we live? Egypt, we know, is later to be the one who oppresses Israel. But does that then give reason or justification for Egypt to be oppressed? I think there's something to learn here. In fact,
We have to understand that in the world of the Bible, someone said in the Middle East, things change all the time. It's hard to begin to identify this is an enemy, this is a friend, because if we look to Egypt and we say Egypt is the arch enemy of Israel, they enslave them and so forth. But is that to be the case forever? Look with me to Isaiah 19. Isaiah chapter 19. I'm going to read you a story, just a few verses, Isaiah 19, about Egypt in the latter days. One of the greatest enemies of the people of God, Egypt. And it says the following, beginning in verse 19, Isaiah 19, 19. In that day, there will be an altar to Jehovah in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar at the border thereof to Jehovah. And it will be a sign and for a witness unto Jehovah of hosts in the land of Egypt, for they will cry unto Jehovah because of oppressors, and he will send them a savior and a defender, and he will deliver them. And Jehovah shall be known to Egypt, and the Egyptians shall know Jehovah in that day. Yea, they shall worship with sacrifice and oblation, and shall vow a vow unto Jehovah and shall perform it. Jehovah will smite Egypt, smiting and healing, and they shall return unto Jehovah, and he will be entreated of them and will heal them. In that day, there'll be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria, and the Egyptian shall worship with the Assyrians. In that day shall Israel be the third with Egypt and with Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the earth. For that Jehovah of hosts has blessed them, saying, listen, blessed be Egypt my people, and Assyria the work of my hands, and Israel mine inheritance. You see, it's easy for us to take sides, but I think we have to have a mind that's able to absorb the magnitude of the miracle that God is going to perform. You see, Israel has a great task. Israel is to be a servant. And by being a servant and knowing the heart of a servant, they are to treat other servants with respect and dignity and be above reproach when it comes to their behavior towards that servant. Much is expected. To whom much is given, much is required. There's no time. There's no time that one can drop the guard. You see, because God's people are judged within a hair's breadth. We have to be above reproach. It's a never-ending job. You can't stop doing good at any point. As we look to Avram and to Sarai in our search for Jehovah and our pursuit of righteousness, I want to caution us all to learn from the good as well as the bad. There's indeed a promise of a seed that's coming, and we know from the text so far that it's not Eliezer or Damasek Eliezer. It's not Eliezer of Damascus. We're going to learn that it's not Ishmael that we're talking about. But still yet, there's a promise of a seed that will be as the dust of the earth and the stars of the heaven. The ancient prophetic text that's assigned as the prophet reading for this chapter, you know, following this ancient triennial cycle of readings, there are prophetic texts, just like in the annual cycle of readings. These go back to ancient times. And I have a list that I've published on the website that includes all of these Torah portions for the triennial cycle, as well as the readings from the prophets. Now, we have three ancient testaments to a single verse from the prophets that's assigned to Genesis 16. All three agree. Some of these aren't so accurate. Some of them you might find in certain ancient works that assigns a different prophet reading. But there's only three ancient lists that give us a prophet reading for Genesis 16, and all three agree. It's Isaiah 51. I'm sorry, Isaiah 54, verse 1. Let's go read it. Isaiah 54, 1. This is attested in three ancient sources as the prophet reading that goes with Genesis 16. Sing, O barren, you that did not bear, break forth into singing and cry aloud, you that did not travail with child, for more are the children of the desolate than the children of the married wife, saith Jehovah. This particular prophetic text is an encouragement to the wife of the barren. If you read in context, it deals with the promised seed, and it's almost as if the rabbis are associating, those who made this connection are associating the right behavior with what should have been. Not that this barren one should oppress, but that this barren one in all faithfulness should sing, knowing that the promise is yet to come. Interestingly enough, there's one person, although I don't agree with what they do with this particular text, but there's one person that I know from antiquity that associates the story of Hagar with Isaiah 54. His name is Paul. Again, I'm not a fan of his exegesis of the text. I don't agree with his analogy. I'll make it very plain when we get to Genesis 21. But I can tell you that what it does do is it confirms the antiquity of this set of readings. That in ancient times, the rabbis or the teachers knew that when you talked about Hagar and the story of her, you associate it with Isaiah 54:1. So think about that. And for those of you who just want to wait until my book is written, that's one of the passages that I use when I'm working on this particular section right now, by the way. So here's the practical advice that I have for us today based on Genesis 16. This is practical advice for holy living based upon a story of Hagar. You ready for it? Though it tarry, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not lie. You see, God's promises are going to come. We must remain faithful. We can't let our guard down. We simply have to believe. And while we're believing, we have to remain patient. Because trust and belief in God's promises do yield righteousness, but one can quickly tip the scale from righteousness to wickedness in our behavior towards others. Remember, the greatest thing we can do is be a servant to all. Shabbat shalom.